Chapter 26. I came out of the chief physician's room. Custer was waiting for me in the hall. He stood up when he saw me. We went outside and sat on a bench in front of the sanatorium. "It's bad, Otto," said I. "Worse than I feared." A group of skiers passed noisily close in front of us. Some oil-besmeared women with powerful sunburnt faces and big white sets of teeth. They shouted to one another that they were hungry as wolves. We waited till they were past. "That sort lives, of course," said I. "Live and are well to the very marrow. Make you sick." "Did you speak to the chief physician himself?" asked Custer. "Yes. He explained it all, with plenty of reservations and qualifications. But the upshot is, it has got worse. He even maintained it was better." "I don't follow." "He says if she had stayed below, all hope would have been gone long ago. Here it has gone slower. That he calls better." Custer drew marks with the heel of his shoe in the hard snow. Then he stood up. "He has hope, then." "A doctor always has hope. It belongs to his job. But I have damned little anymore. I asked him if he'd done a pneumothorax. He said it was no use now. She had one some years ago. Now both lungs are affected." "It's the devil, Otto." An old woman with overtrodden galoshes stepped in front of our seat. She had a blue, decayed face and slate-colored, extinct eyes that looked as if they were blind. About her neck she had wound an old-fashioned feather boa. Slowly she raised a lorgnette and examined us. Then she shuffled on. "Nasty-looking ghost," I spat. "What else did he say?" asked Custer. "He explained how it probably came about. He had had quite a lot of patients around the same age, a result of the war. Undernourishment in the growing years. But what's that to do with me? She has to get well." I looked at him. Of course, he told me he had experienced miracles often. With this disease particularly, it happens that sometimes it suddenly stops, encapsules and heals up, even in desperate cases. Yaffe said that too. But I don't believe in miracles. Custer did not answer. We remained sitting side by side in silence. What could we say? We had both seen too much to be able to do anything in the comforting line. "She mustn't notice anything, Bob," said Custer at last. "Of course," I replied. We continued to sit till Pat came. I thought nothing. I didn't even despair. I was just stupefied and gray and dead. "There she is," said Custer. "Yes," said I, standing up. "Hello." Pat came toward us and waved. She staggered a little and laughed. "I'm a bit drunk, with the sun. Always when I've been lying in the sun, I roll like an old sailor." I looked at her, and at a stroke it was all different. I didn't believe the doctor anymore. I believed the miracle. There she was. She was alive. There she stood laughing. All the rest sank before it. "What are you making such long faces about?" she asked.
"Town faces that don't fit here," said Custer. "We can't get used to the sun."
She laughed. "Today's a good day for me. No temperature. I can go out. Shall we go down to the village and have an aperitif?" "Sure. Off we go, then."
"Shouldn't we take a sleigh, though?" asked Custer.
"I can stand it," said Pat.
"I know that," said Custer, "but I've never ridden in one of those things. I'd like to try once."
We beckoned a driver and drove down the hairpin bends to the village. Outside a cafe that had a little sunny lawn, we stopped and got out. All sorts of people were there, and some I recognized from the sanatorium. The Italian from the bar was among them. He was called Antonio,
and came to our table to greet Pat. He told us some practical jokers last night had rolled one patient while he slept, bed and all, out of his room into the room of the Stone Age schoolmistress. "Why did they do that?" I asked. "He's cured and going out in a few days," replied Antonio. "They're always doing that sort of thing."
"It's the famous gallows humor of those who are left behind, darling," said Pat.
"One does get childish up here," observed Antonio apologetically. Cured, thought I. One is cured and going back.
"What do you want to drink, Pat?" I asked. "A martini. A good dry martini."
A radio started to play. Viennese waltzes. They floated through the warm, sunny air like soft, bright banners. The waiter brought the martinis. They were very cold, and beating still as the sun shone on them.
"Lovely to sit like this, isn't it?"
"Grand," I replied.
"But sometimes it's unbearable," said she.
We remained down to lunch. Pat wanted it particularly. Latterly, she had had to stay in the sanatorium, and this was her first outing. She had told them there she would feel twice as well if only she could lunch in the village. Antonio dined with us. Afterwards, we drove up again, and Pat went to her room to lie down for 2 hours. Custer and I fetched Carl from the garage and looked him over. We had to change 2 broken springs. The garage man had tools, and we set to work. Then we filled up with oil and greased the chassis thoroughly. When all was done, we pushed him out. With hanging ears and spattered with mud, he stood in the snow. "Should we wash him?" I asked. "No, not en route," said Custer. "He doesn't like it." Pat joined us. She looked warm and rested. Her dog was jumping around her. "Billy," I called. He stopped and looked, but he wasn't over-friendly. He did not recognize me, and was quite disconcerted when Pat called my attention to him. "So soon," said I. "Thank God human beings have better memories. Where was he yesterday, then?" Pat laughed.
"He lay under the bed the whole day. He's jealous when I have visitors, and then retires and sulks."
"You look wonderful," said I. She glanced at me happily. Then she walked up to Carl.
"I would like to sit in it again and drive a little way."
"Why not?" said I. "What do you say, Otto?" "Of course. You have a thick coat, and here are rugs and wraps enough." Pat sat forward behind the windshield beside Custer. Carl bellowed. The exhaust gas steamed blue-white in the cold air. The engine was not warm yet. Slowly clapping, the chains began to eat their way through the snow. Spitting, cracking, and snarling, Carl crept down to the village and along the main street, a crouching wolf amid the trample of horses and tinkle of sleigh bells. We came out of the village. It was late afternoon, and the snowfields glowed red, tinged by the descending sun. Some ricks on the slope lay almost buried in whiteness. Like tiny commas, the last skiers dropped down into the valley. As they did so, they passed under the red sun that appeared once more, mighty beyond the slope, a ball of dusky fire.
"Did you come along here yesterday?" asked Pat.
"Yes." The car topped the summit of the first ascent. Custer stopped. The view from here was overpowering. The day before, as we sped along through the glassy blue evening, we had not even noticed it. We had had eyes for nothing but the road. Rise beyond rise, the manifold valley opened. The ridges of the distant ranges stood out sharp and clear against the pale green sky. They glowed golden. Golden flecks lay dusted over the snowfields at the foot of the peaks. From moment to moment, the slopes took on an ever more gorgeous whitish red, and the shadow became even bluer.
The sun stood in the gap between two shimmering peaks, and the broad valley with its dips and rises was like some vast, mute, glittering parade before a dying ruler. The violet ribbon of the road wound among the hills, disappeared, reappeared, dark at the bends, past villages, and then ran straight along the saddle of the pass to the horizon.
"I've never been so far from the village before," said Pat. "Is that the road home?"
"Yes." She was silent and looked at it. Then she got out and held her hand shading her eyes. And so she peered into the north, as if she could see already the spires of the city.
"How far is it?" she asked.
"About 1,000 kilometers. In May, we'll go along there. Otto is fetching us."
"In May?" she repeated. "My God, in May."
Slowly the sun sank. The valley came to life. Shadows that hitherto had been squatting fixed in the folds of the ground started noiselessly to creep out and climb higher like blue gigantic spiders. It turned cool.
"We must get back, Pat," said I.
She looked up, and her face was suddenly stricken with pain. I saw at once that she knew everything. She knew she would never escape beyond that pitiless chain of mountains on the skyline. She knew it, and meant to hide it, just as we had meant to hide it from her. But for one moment, she lost her grip, and all the misery of the world broke in her eyes.
"Let's go down, just a little way," said she. "Just a little way down."
"Come," said I, after a glance at Custer. She got in at the back with me. I bedded her in my arm and pulled the rugs over us both. The car began slowly to descend the mountain, into the valley and the shadows.
"Robbie, darling,"
whispered Pat on my shoulder.
"Now it's as if we were driving home, back into our life."
"Yes," said I, and covered her up to the hair. It grew rapidly darker the lower we came. Pat lay completely under the covers. She thrust her hand into my chest, under the shirt. I felt her hand on my skin, then her breath, her lips, and then her tears. Cautiously, so she should not notice the turn, Custer swung the car in a long sweep on the marketplace of the next village and drove slowly back. The sun had vanished when we drove again over the summit, and already in the east, pale and clear between the rising clouds, stood the moon. We drove back. The chains ground over the snow with a monotonous sound. The evening became still. I sat motionless and felt Pat's tears on my heart, as if a wound were bleeding there. An hour later, I was sitting in the hall. Pat was in her room, and Custer had gone to the weather bureau to find out whether it was going to snow. It had turned misty outside. The moon now had a ring, and soft and gray as velvet, the night stood at the window. After a while, Antonio came and joined me. A few tables away sat a tight, round, bumptious fellow like a cannonball, in homespun coat and knickerbockers too short for him. He had a baby face with pouting lips and cold eyes, and on top a round red head without hair, shiny as a billiard ball. Beside him was a thin woman with deep shadows under the eyes and a troubled, imploring expression. The cannonball was lively, his head in constant movement, his rosy little hands describing plump gestures. "Marvelous up here, quite superb. The panorama, the air, the attention. You're well off, really."
"Bernhard," said his wife gently.
"Truly, I wouldn't mind some of it. Coddled and looked after."
Oily laughter.
"Still, I don't begrudge you."
"Ach, Bernhard,"
said his wife dispiritedly.
"What now? Come now."
The cannonball clattered gaily on.
"You couldn't have better anywhere.
Why, you're in paradise here. Think of us down below there, out again every morning into the muck. You be thankful you're spared that. But I'm glad to see you getting on so well here.
Bernhard, I'm not getting on well, said his wife.
But my child, Bernhard bustled on, don't you complain? It's we ought to do that. Bankruptcy everywhere, always on the go, taxes. Still, we're glad to be able to do it, of course.
The woman said nothing. A nice lad, said I to Antonio.
Is he not? Replied Antonio. Since the day before yesterday, he's been here, talking down every attempt of his wife's with his wonderfully well off you are. He just refuses to see, you know, neither her fear, her sickness, or her loneliness. And all the time he's probably living in Berlin with another cannonball just like himself, paying his duty call here every 6 months, rubbing his hands, jovial, studying only his own convenience, and not listening to anything. You often see it up here.
How long has his wife been here?
About 2 years.
A troop of young people ran giggling into the hall. Antonio laughed.
They've come from the post. They've been sending a telegram to Roth.
Who's Roth?
He's the next to go out. They've wired him not to come home because of an influenza epidemic in the town, and that he'd best stay on here. One of the usual jokes. Because they have to stay themselves, you see.
I looked out the window at the gray, satin-hung mountain. It just isn't true, all this, thought I. Just isn't real. It doesn't go like this. This is only a stage where they act a bit at death. When men die, it's in grim earnest. I should have liked to follow these young folk and shake them by the shoulders and say to them, "It is so, isn't it? This is just a charade of death, and you mere facetious amateurs acting at dying. You'll get up again after and bow, won't you? People just don't die this way, from a bit of fever and noisy breathing. It takes bullets and wounds. I know that."
"Are you sick too?" I asked Antonio.
"Of course," said he, smiling.
"Perfectly delicious coffee," rattled the cannonball alongside. "Nothing like that with us, I tell you. An absolute lotus land."
Custer came back from the Weather Bureau.
"I must go, Bob," said he. "The glass has dropped, and there'll be snow tonight, probably. Then tomorrow I wouldn't get through. Tonight I'll just make it."
"Right. Is there time for supper together?"
"Yes. I'll pack quickly now."
"I'll come over." We packed Custer's things and brought them down to the garage. Then we went back to get Pat.
"Give us a call if anything happens, Bob," said Otto.
I nodded. "The money will be here in a few days. Enough for a while. Do whatever's necessary."
"Yes, Otto," I hesitated. "We've got some files of morphia back home. Can you send them?"
He looked at me.
"What do you want them for?"
"I don't know how it will be here. It may not be necessary. I still have hope of a sort, in spite of everything, always when I see her. But I wouldn't like her to suffer, Otto. That she should lie around and nothing be there of her but just pain. Perhaps they'd give her some here themselves in that case, but it would be a comfort to me to know I can help her."
"Only that, Bob?" asked Custer.
"Only that, Otto, truly. I wouldn't ask you otherwise."
He nodded. "We are only two now," said he, slowly.
"Yes."
"All right, Bob."
We went into the hall and I fetched Pat down. Then we ate quickly, for it was growing steadily more overcast. Custer drove Carl from the garage up to the door.
"Good luck, Bob," said he.
"Same to you, Otto."
"Au revoir, Pat."
He shook hands and looked at her.
"I'll come and fetch you in the spring."
"Goodbye, Custer,"
She held his hand fast. I'm so very glad to have seen you again. Give my greetings to Gottfried Lentz, too.
Yes, said Custer. She still held his hand. Her lips quivered. And suddenly she took a step forward and kissed him.
Goodbye,
she murmured in a choking voice. Custer's face suddenly lit up with a bright red flame. He meant to say something, but then turned away, got into the car, set off with a bound, and raced down the hairpin bends without looking round. We watched him. The car thundered along the main street and climbed the zigzag ascent like a solitary firefly, the pallid field of the searchlight moving over the gray snow ahead. At the summit, the car stopped, and Custer waved. He stood out dark against the light. Then he vanished, and for a long time still, we heard only the hum of the engine, growing steadily fainter. Pat stood leaning forward, listening as long as anything was still to be heard. Then she turned to me.
The last ship has left, Robbie.
The second last, I replied. I'm the last. And do you know what I propose doing? I'm going to look for a new anchorage. I don't like the room in the annex anymore. I don't see why we shouldn't live together. I'm going to try and get a room in your neighborhood. She smiled.
Quite impossible. You'll never do it. How are you going to start?
Would you be glad if I did manage it?
What a question. It would be grand, darling. Almost as good as at Mother Zalewski's.
Right. Then just leave me to get busy for half an hour.
All right. I'll play a game of chess with Antonio. That's one thing I've learnt up here.
I went to the office and explained that I should be staying rather longer and would like a room on the same floor with Pat. An elderly, flat-chested matron refused indignantly because of the house regulations. Who made the regulations? I asked.
The management,
retorted the matron, smoothing the folds of her dress. Rather reluctantly, she did finally inform me that the doctor in charge had discretion in exceptional cases.
But he has gone now, she added. At night he goes home and is not to be disturbed except on business.
Good, said I. Then I'll trouble him on business, a matter of the house regulations. The doctor lived in a small house next to the sanatorium. He received me immediately and gave me permission at once. Judging from the start, I didn't expect it to be quite so easy, said I. He laughed. Uh-huh. You ran into old Rexroth, probably. Well, I'll just telephone. I returned to the office. Rexroth beat a dignified retreat as she caught sight of my defiant face. I arranged everything with the secretary and gave the manservant the job of shifting my stuff across and getting me a few bottles of drink. Then I went to Pat in the hall.
Have you managed it? She asked.
Not yet, but in a few days I will.
That's a pity.
She overturned the chessmen and stood up. What should we do? I asked. Go to the bar. We often play cards, said Antonio. The fern's coming. You can feel it. Cards are best, then.
Cards? Pat, said I in surprise. What cards can you play?
Black Peter and Patience, eh?
Poker, darling, announced Pat.
I laughed. She can, really, said Antonio. Only she's a bit reckless. She bluffs terribly. So do I replied. We must try our hand. We sat in a corner and started playing. Pat did not poker badly at all, but she bluffed to glory. After an hour, Antonio pointed out the window. It was snowing. Slowly, as if still hesitating, the fat flakes fell almost vertically down. There's not a breath of wind, said Antonio. That means a lot of snow.
Where will Custer be now?
Asked Pat. He's well over the pass, said I. For an instant, I saw Carl quite distinctly trailing with Custer through the snow, and suddenly it all seemed unreal. That I should be sitting here, that Custer should be on the road, and that Pat should be there. She smiled at me happily, pressing her hand with the cards onto the table.
Fire away, Robbie.
The cannonball bowled in, came to rest behind our table, and began rocking benevolently back and forth on his toes. His wife was asleep, no doubt, and he was in search of entertainment. I laid down the cards and stared at him poisonously till he vanished.
You're not very friendly, said Pat, pleased.
No, said I. Didn't mean to be. We went into the bar and drank a few specials. Then Pat had to go to bed. I took leave of her in the hall. She walked slowly up the stairs and looked round and stopped before she turned into the corridor. I waited a bit, then got my room key at the office. The little secretary smiled.
Number 78, said she.
It was the room next to Pat's. At Fräulein Rexroth's suggestion, no doubt.
No. Fräulein Rexroth is in the Mission House, she replied.
Mission houses have their uses sometimes, said I, and went swiftly up. My things were already unpacked. Half an hour later, I knocked on the communicating door between the two rooms.
Who's there?
Called Pat. The surveillance police, I replied. The key grated in the lock, and the door flew open.
You, Robbie,
stammered Pat, completely taken by surprise. Me, said I. Conqueror of Fräulein Rexroth. Cognac and Portoronco proprietor. I drew the bottles from the pockets of my dressing gown. And now tell me at once, how many men have been here already?
None.
Except the football club and the Philharmonic Orchestra, announced Pat, laughing.
Ah, darling, now the old times are here again.
She fell asleep on my shoulder. I stayed awake a long time. In one corner of the room, a small lamp was burning. The snowflakes knocked lightly on the window, and in the soft, golden-brown twilight, time seemed to stand still. Occasionally, the pipes of the central heating cracked. Pat turned in her sleep, and slowly, rustling, the bedclothes slipped to the floor. Ah, thought I. Bronze, shimmering skin. Slender miracle of the knee. Soft mystery of the breast. I felt her hair on my shoulder, and the pulse of her blood under my lips. You are to die, thought I. You cannot die. You are happiness. Cautiously, I pulled up the clothes again. Pat murmured something, and was silent again, and put her hand slowly, in sleep, around my shoulder.